Good morning and welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. When it comes to our marine environment, there are dozens of competing interests: fisheries, conservation, renewable energy, shipping, and marine mammals, just to name a few. Adding to the complexity are multiple management agencies in federal, local, and state waters. Planning that represents all these interests allows for a viable economic model and aims for long-term sustainability. It might seem like a pipe dream, but a new film by Greenfrier Productions brings us face-to-face with people who've embarked on the journey. Ocean Frontiers 2, A New England Story for Sustaining the Sea, covers the delicate process of planning what could be America's first offshore wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island, and focuses on the partnerships formed between unlikely players. And joining us to discuss the film and the issues is Karen Meyer. She's a filmmaker and co-founder of Greenfrier Productions. She's joining us on the phone from somewhere in western Mexico. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
And from our studios at WGBH in Boston, we have Les Kaufman, professor of biology at the Boston University Marine Program and marine conservation fellow at the Betty and Gordon Moore Center for Ecosystem Science and Economics. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Stephanie Moore, who is the founding executive director of Sea Plan. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
And then in studio with me is Dr. Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab here on WCAI. Good morning, Heather.
Good to be here.
All right, Karen, a film about ocean management is probably not at the top of the list for most filmmakers, but you've made two films on this topic. Your first one was Ocean Frontiers, The Dawn of a New Era in Ocean Stewardship, and now we've got Ocean Frontiers 2, A New England Story for Sustaining the Sea. So tell us where you got the ideas for these films and a bit more about Greenfrier Productions.
Sure. So we were working on ocean conservation in a series of films in the early 2000s. And as we finished those up, we started asking the scientists who we were working with, what's the next step in terms of ocean conservation and ocean management? And they stated very clearly that we need to start to look at our oceans holistically and do what's called ecosystem-based management for the ocean, or marine spatial planning. So these are wonky terms that few of us know what they mean just right when you hear it. And people were having a hard time conveying what they were. And we thought, well, if this is where we need to go, we better understand it better. Mm-hmm. So we set out to find the stories that would make this more understandable and look at why do we need to take a new course? What are the problems that we're facing? What are the benefits that people are seeing from ocean planning? And so we went directly to people around the country who were in the midst of pioneering efforts around ocean planning to hear directly from them.
So ocean management, of course, is complex. There are not just federal, state, local governing bodies, but so many different interests: renewables, fisheries, conservation, recreation, shipping. Les, in the past, these have all been managed separately, which you noted is a simpler way to do it, but really not a sustainable way of management. So where do things start to break down in a piecemeal approach to marine ecosystem management?
Well, anytime anybody does something out in the ocean, it's going to affect everybody else. So in places like Massachusetts, this was appreciated some years ago and a law was passed called the Mass Oceans Act. Basically says before you do anything in the ocean, you have to figure out who else will be affected and take that into account. And ultimately, it simplifies things because you don't have so many lawyers involved.
Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, it's like what we do on land, zoning. But zoning more for the sea.
Well, and I think Karen's point, you know, the name being so opaque, mm-hmm. when I first encountered it, because the one thing that's not in that name is the actual key part, which everyone's been touching on, which is the fact that it's very comprehensive, it's all-inclusive, and collaborative. And somehow, you know, you don't want a name that's five words long, mm-hmm. but somehow that name doesn't really convey that key part of it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so Stephanie, you're the founding director of Sea Plan, and part of your mission is to bring all the stakeholders to the table in ocean planning. So tell us more about Sea Plan and how it came to be.
Sure. Sea Plan is, we're an independent nonprofit group. By independent, I mean we're not advocating for any particular outcome or any interest, you know, whether that's conservation or any particular industry interest. What we're interested in is bringing the best available information and science to the dialogue, to the discussion forums, and to the decision-making forums so that the affected stakeholders and the government decision-makers can actually hopefully make wiser and good decisions that are more sustainable. So I think you raised a good point in your introduction, which is that there are some interesting partnerships that are formed when we're doing ocean planning, and I think that's a really interesting side of the story. So a lot of what we know about the ocean certainly comes from science and scientists doing research out there, but a lot of what we know about the ocean also needs to come from the stakeholders themselves, from the people who make their living on the ocean and who work near the waterfront. The information that they have is also data, so to speak. So making sure that those conversations are captured and that information is reflected in the decision process is another really important aspect.
Getting all the stakeholders to the table, too, it sounds so easy. We'll get everybody in the same room, but getting everybody to agree on things is not always an easy thing to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Right?
I mean, I know. I've attended a couple of the meetings that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and whatever the R and the E is on the end of that have held, mm-hmm. In New Bedford. And even once you've got everybody in the room, if they are trusting enough to come to the room for the conversation, there have been some really tense conversations.
Sure. Yeah.
Because there are competing interests and people aren't necessarily used to working together. So I think these success stories are really interesting right. to hear about.
And of course, Karen, this with the film, this film takes us to Rhode Island and introduces us to both the process of collaborative management and the different stakeholders involved as Rhode Island plans its first offshore wind farm. And as you may know, a large wind farm has been proposed off the coast of Cape Cod, but that process has largely played out in the court. So tell us more about the Rhode Island process and the stakeholders involved there.
Well, what we found is that Rhode Island did a very good job of bringing everybody to the table and starting to build trust. And trust wasn't there at the onset, even among the conservation groups, industry groups. They weren't really sure where this process was going to go. And so one of the things that was interesting that they conveyed is that it really took a leap of faith at a certain point that this was going to be a helpful process to them. Mm-hmm. And because we don't have a lot of examples of this yet, we are operating on this leap of faith to move us forward and to believe that having everybody together around the table, getting our issues out, and discussing them and coming up with, rational solutions that work the best for everyone as well as for the marine environment is our best way forward.
Yeah. Stephanie, as we're just mentioning, there are many stakeholders when it comes to the marine environment and competing for resources in space. So can you describe the process of marine spatial planning and how it can help balance these resource demands?
Sure. Let me take a quick stab at it, and then my colleagues can certainly add to that. So as you guys pointed out, the term marine spatial planning leaves a little bit wanting. It isn't just about spatial planning. So let's take the Massachusetts example, Rhode Island's neighborhood that's a neighbor that's featured in the film. So Massachusetts has also gone through a statewide ocean management planning process under the direction of the Oceans Act that Les mentioned. We're actually, interestingly enough, getting ready to do the first formal amendment to that ocean planning process that's due out this year. And so really when you think about it, it really at its core is just planning. It's mm-hmm. sort of like smart growth for the oceans. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is to figure out what are the goals or objectives that you're trying to accomplish, and over what time horizon are you going to plan? Are you going to plan for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years in the future? What kinds of changes are you going to try to anticipate? So theoretically, you identify your goals and objectives first, and then you think, what existing data do we have? What do we know about how people use the ocean? What do we know about the habitats and ecologically sensitive areas? Try to get all that information together. And then think about how you overlay the existing human uses, and like commercial fishing or recreational fishing and boating, and how you overlay those with the planned or anticipated uses like developing new aquaculture installations or renewable energy. And essentially, through a series of mapping exercises and images, you begin to see how these things fit together and where there may be conflicts, where there may be compatibilities. And as Les is good at pointing out, all this is predicated on the underlying marine ecosystem's ability to support those human uses. And taking that into account, you in a sense get you aim to get a sense of what is the threshold. You know, how much of what kind of uses can this particular area in the ocean support or tolerate without really compromising or damaging the underlying marine ecosystem structure and its function. Mm. And then a really important part of this is once a plan is done or any management decision, you need to pay attention to how it's working. You know, how are the affected stakeholders, whether it's fishermen or renewable energy developers, how are they feeling about it? What's their response to it? How is the underlying, you know, ecosystem responding? Are things getting better? Are things getting worse? So you need to pay attention to sort of what's happening. What's the performance of the management decision that you've just made? And what can you learn from that to make an even better decision the next time? Mm.
Les, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think it. I'm excited by this conversation. I don't know how many other people are, but the, under the hood of this is an enormous scientific adventure that stands on two legs. One is the study of complex systems and how they work. Your body is a complex system. The cosmos is a complex system. And tucked in the middle there is the world ocean. And complex systems do the most peculiar things. And, of course, that fascinates a scientist like me. The other new area of science here is called coupled human and natural systems. We used to just call it ecology. But there's a very, very – we have only a primitive understanding of how we influence the world. Most people are oblivious of it through their whole lives. And now we're having to come to grips with it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what happens when you unleash a superabundant intelligent species on the surface of a fragile planet is really interesting. And what we're doing in ocean planning is coming eye to eye with that problem.
Hmm. Well, I think one of the interesting – talking about the science that's involved, I mean, obviously there's the ecology that's involved, but the whole idea of doing really stakeholder-involved collaborative management like this, there's actually – been a lot of research in the past several years that's showing that collaborative resource management like that is far more effective.
Oh, yeah.
That not only does everybody end up being happier with the result, but the ecological results, the economic results really are much better. And so it's not necessarily our human nature to immediately go into this very collaborative way of working, but it really is the data-driven, the supported way of doing it.
Yeah. We're talking about ocean planning. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking ocean planning. Our guest this morning, Les Kaufman, professor of biology at Boston University, Stephanie Mora, founding executive director of CPLAN, Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab here on WCAI, and Karen Meyer, filmmaker with Green Fire Productions. Karen, one of the things we should mention, Green Fire Productions doesn't just make films. Part of your mission is working with NGOs, natural resource agencies, and industry associations to screen the films and have audiences become engaged in the issues and conversations like we're having this morning. WCAI is participating in this process. We're hosting the film Ocean Frontiers 2 as part of our Sunday screening series this Sunday at the New Bedford Historical Whaling Park, and we have details on our website. But this is something that you've been doing with other groups and really creating some dialogue in communities about ocean planning. And how's it been going so far?
Well, this response has been tremendous. We've worked with over 600 organizations, like you just mentioned, NGOs and natural resource agencies and industry associations across the country to host more than 700 screenings in 37 states and 3 U.S. territories. And that's all done with the volunteer efforts of folks around the country who want to bring this film to their communities or to host a brown bag lunch screening for their work colleagues. Or show it in their classrooms, like Les has done with his students at BU.
Les, part of your research as a biologist is creating ecological economic models of coastal ecosystems. Am I right that you are essentially looking at both the human and natural components of the system together? And can you describe some of the areas you're studying and what you're learning?
Well, that's right. I have to confess I'm down with the fish and the people totally perplex me. But what we're doing is studying right now Massachusetts Bay very closely out to Stellwagen Bank. And we're looking at the linkages in the system so we can understand, for example, if we were to tune up the fishery for herring, what would the impact be on the whale watch industry? Or if we were to back off from the rivers that feed Mass Bay and let the trees grow back, how would that improve the food available for the cod and haddock and other groundfish? Because a tremendous amount of the nutrients and a lot of the anadromous fish that the big fish eat come out of the watershed. Mm-hmm. The other thing we're trying to do, trepidatiously, is understand and anticipate how people will react to new information. Right now, our ability to predict human behavior is pretty abysmal. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why the stakeholders really, really matter. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping to find that the relationship between people and nature is lawful, that it's actually something we can understand and make the road a little smoother, a little easier the next time around. Mm.
Well, most human uses of the ocean have a land-based component to them, infrastructure and businesses that support the activities at sea. So how much land-based planning is necessary to make marine spatial successful?
Well, they go hand in hand. We think of the system as the watershed and coastal ocean. You really can't separate them. The value chains, the chain of following the money, goes all over the world from the moment that someone plunks a quarter down on a counter in Gloucester. So what we have to do is imagine this as sort of a hierarchical system where we're focused on Mass Bay or on a particular town along the coast, but we're able to visualize the anatomy of the connections between a person standing at the waterfront in Massachusetts and who knows, somebody on a beach in Southeast Asia, for all we know.
Mm, yeah. Stephanie, we mentioned Massachusetts sort of the forefront with this collaborative planning approach. In 2010, we adopted that Massachusetts Ocean Management Plan. Can you describe a little bit more how the plan will impact the management of our marine resources?
Yeah, let me give you first a little bit of a generic answer and then point to a really good sort of living example. What I think is really brilliant and nifty because it's so simple about the Mass Ocean Plan is that essentially what it did not set out very specific use zones, for example, like they have on the Great Barrier Reef. What it did instead is say, let's map, essentially, let's identify where our very important ecological resources are, whether that's fish spawning grounds or whale habitat or bird migratory paths, whatever it happens to be. Let's just understand and plunk down on a map where those places are, and then let's understand where are the sort of high-use areas, whether that's, again, for recreational boating, commercial fishing, aquaculture, whatever it is. So let's basically understand where things are, and then let's understand how they interact and impact one another. And what we'll do is make some very specific management standards that say, for example, if you are a utility, you want to install a cable or a pipeline, the kinds of impacts that you have when you install that. Well, what do? You dig up the bottom of the ocean. That has certain impacts. Which kinds of ecological resources are vulnerable to those kinds of impacts? Fish spawning grounds, eelgrass beds, those kinds of things. And so you essentially very specifically lay out management standards that say, okay, you developer, if you have a project that's going to impact the ocean in these kinds of ways, you really shouldn't do it here. You should try. You should look for a place where those kinds of sensitive resources don't exist, and thereby having a much easier time getting your permits through. Mm. And so it is. It's remarkably simple and remarkably effective, at least in the in the early stages of implementation. So, just by way of quick example, and I believe actually that WCAI reported on this story right before Christmas. There is a proposed, actually not proposed, now approved and in construction, a coupled fiber optic and electric cable from Comcast and NSTAR that's being run from the mainland over to the islands. And the reason that is a nifty example is that that proposal came through from the utilities after the Mass Ocean Plan was enacted. And what the companies were able to do is say, I see. Now, ahead of time, the state and others involved have mapped the areas where my project would have the greatest impact. And if I really want to get my project through with the least amount of permitting headaches, I really should find a route that doesn't go there. And so what Comcast did was they essentially found a route that impacts that uses a different technology. So instead of digging up the ocean, they use a technology that drills under sensitive areas like eelgrass beds, essentially not touching them at all. And then when it comes to an area where it's just a sandy sea bottom, then they can come back up to the bottom and use the usual trench, again, having little or no impact. And so for the project proponents, for the people who are trying to do business in the ocean, it really saved them time and arguably money. Yeah. Seaplan's actually writing a case study about this now. We're finishing up interviews with a lot of the folks that were involved in the project. So I don't have any numbers yet, but we know for sure it saved time. Mm-hmm. And even on the permitting side, for the state agencies that had to review these project permits, their process was made simpler. And simpler and more effective by having the ocean plan in place in advance with the standards identified and the sensitive resources mapped. So that's a great example, real life, of an ocean management plan helping both the developers who want to do business in the ocean, the conservation interests and others who want to protect the eelgrass beds in this example, and the state resource managers who have to review and issue permits on these projects.
You know, my favorite part of that story was, you know, because it's generated a lot of interest, all that big equipment over on Surf Drive. And what are they doing? Yeah. Big fence. My favorite part of that story is if you stand by the no trespassing sign long enough, somebody will come out and tell you what's going on.
Oh, that's good. I'll remember that for the future.
So President Obama created a National Ocean Council in 2010. And over the past 3 to 4 years, they've produced a National Ocean Policy and Implementation Plan. So what's the relationship between state and federal plans?
Well, if I can take that, the states have been in the vanguard in ocean planning, but I think they facilitated, they made it easier for us to consolidate a federal approach. People who aren't familiar with the benefits of ocean planning are often afraid of it. So it was good to have some examples in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, and in California, the three most progressive states in ocean planning. And I think it helped put people at ease when the National Ocean Policy came along. There's still a deep-seated fear in some quarters of any legislation or regulation that appears to infringe on our freedoms. But we don't have freedom to go out and shoot each other, and we don't have freedom to drive a car like a maniac. And running around the ocean doing stuff without thinking about the consequences for others is pretty much the same thing. So ocean planning is not an infringement on people's freedoms. It's an attempt to protect those freedoms from the unwitting effects of things that other people might do. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's just common sense.
So although ocean planning is designed to engage all stakeholders at the table, support for the National Ocean Policy and Implementation Plan is not universally supported on Capitol Hill, which is, I guess, what you're referring to. So what are the issues that the critics have of the plan?
Well, I think it's sort of, as Les put it, that there are certain ocean-dependent industries that feel any additional effort to coordinate management of the ocean constitutes an additional burden to them mm-hmm. or an impediment to operating their business. And I think that just it rubs folks the wrong way. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to get dramatic, but some of the hearings that you're referring to in Capitol Hill, you know, some lawmakers have referred to ocean planning as socialism in the ocean. And, you know, as Les puts it, it's really about trying to really protect the freedoms of folks interested in conservation or in shipping or in aquaculture, whatever it happens to be, to ply their trades in a smart way that actually allows us all as a society really to get the maximum amount of cultural, recreational, economic benefits from the ocean without essentially destroying it in the process.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. You know, we wouldn't dream in this day of age of not having zoning laws and use plans on land. But the ocean has always seemed like it's a very different place in our psyche and has always seemed like a frontier, and it kind of has been a wild west.
Like the Wild West.
It's the Wild West, right? And you know, we have that term because that's what we used to have on land, and we made a choice not to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think as we do begin to use the ocean more intensively, which we have already begun to use it more intensively, you know, it's really a necessity.
Yeah. Well, also, too, there's this sort of, unless you were referring to this earlier about people not really kind of being aware, this vastness of the ocean, you just sort of, most people have this thought of, well, it can overcome anything. You know, I mean, it mm-hmm. we don't really, I mean, you think of all the plastics and all that's going on in there that people really are unaware of. It's mind-boggling, really.
Well, one of the problems is that illustrious scientists who preceded our generation also thought that it was invulnerable and limitless, and that hasn't worked out so well for us.
Yeah. Well, the ocean is vast, but most of our use is really concentrated in these coastal areas, and it's not just that, you know, we can do something in the coast and something from the deep ocean will come in and replace it or repair it or fix it. You know, so I think that's an important thing to realize too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say half of humanity is supported by an infinitesimally thin ribbon of life that skirts all the coastlines of the world. And the degree to which we depend on that very thin ribbon, basically the beach and a few miles in each direction, is a little frightening. It's like when you first go up a mountain and realize how thin the atmosphere mm-hmm. is. So we've got to be careful with it.
Yeah. So in the ocean frontiers – go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to link back to the film, which I thought Karen did a screening here in Boston. I had the good fortune to be on the panel, and it was actually my second time seeing it. And, you know, I live, eat, and breathe this stuff every day, and something really struck me the second time around. Karen's film has this great overlay, animated overlay of information that comes out of the Northeast Ocean data catalog, mm-hmm. essentially, which is an online data resource that anybody can access and play with. But what it does is it overlays all the uses about which we have information in the Northeast. So it shows shipping lanes. It shows recreational boating activity. It shows the primary natural resources that folks care about, et cetera. And as those layers pile up on one another, it is startling mm-hmm. how busy the ocean really is. And I honestly think most folks would be shocked if they saw, you know, how much of it is lit up with right. activity.
And I think a lot of people would find it surprising that collecting the data about ocean uses isn't limited to just scientists, that it's important to involve the stakeholders also to determine current and future uses of the ocean. So this website that you're talking about gives a good illustration of that. It's the northeastoceandata.org. We'll put a link up on our website as well. So how do other people contribute to this then, Stephanie?
Well, so a great example of that is a study that was it's a collaborative study that was just completed. It was called the Northeast Recreational Boating Study. And that – so to your point earlier, it was It was a joint study that was conducted by Sea Plan in partnership with the Northeast Regional Ocean Council, which is a collection of state and federal agencies in the Northeast responsible for doing the regional ocean planning that's happening now. The industry, the boating industry itself, so it was industry, government, and an independent nonprofit who collaborated to design and implement a study that allowed us to literally collect data from thousands of registered recreational boaters from New York to Maine, engage them in a six-month survey that allowed them to map their routes, their boating routes, on an online mapping tool, which is really kind of fun to play with, and also to record their, you know, their activities. What did they do out there? Did they just sort of hang around and have a few pops? Did they watch whales? Did they fish? What did they do? So it gives us a sense of what they're doing out there. And also they recorded how much they spent and on what kinds of costs, whether it's fuel, food, docking fees, whatever. And so by taking these hundreds of thousands of data points that we collected over about a six-month period, we were able to essentially quantify or characterize not only where the boats go, which is information nobody ever had before at this scale. So what are the important routes? What are the important areas for boaters? So we want to take that into account when we're planning and not put a wind farm in the middle of it, perhaps. Mm-hmm. What are the important activities they're doing, and what kind of economic impact does that have on the region? And so so we discovered that the recreational boating industry in this Northeast area contributes about $3.5 billion wow. of economic activity, which is that's chump change.
Yeah, billion with a B.
billion with a B. Thank you. And generates the equivalent of about 27,000 full-time jobs. Wow. So this is the kind of information that says, hey, recreational boating, yes, it is fun and games because it has the word recreational in it, but this is a significant economic sector. Mm-hmm. And it's a significant interest group that really cares about what happens in the ocean. So that's an example of getting the ocean users, if you will, in this case boaters, directly involved in generating the data, the spatial data and the economic data upon which ocean management decisions will be made, and which in turn is also useful for the boating industry itself. So that's a great example of that collaborative effort leading to good information that can be used both for industry planning and for planning.
We are talking ocean planning. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a short break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about ocean planning and the film Ocean Frontiers 2, A New England Story for Sustaining the Sea, that we will be screening this Sunday in New Bedford. Our guest this morning, Karen Meyer, Green Fire Productions, Les Kaufman, Professor of Biology at Boston University, Stephanie Mora, Founding Executive Director of Sea Plan, and Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab here on WCAI. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So in the film, someone from the U.S. Navy is interviewed, and many of us might not immediately think of naval operations when you think of ocean use, but the Navy is a large presence in the ocean. How are they part of the ocean planning process, and what are their interests?
Well, from the interview that we did with Joe Atangan, who is the federal representative on the New England regional planning body, as well as in the Mid-Atlantic, they're quite involved in ocean planning. And as you hear from Joe in the film, ocean planning is really paramount to them because they, you know, as he told us, they work below the water, on the water surface, and above the water. And they've been doing this since the inception of our country and do extensive training in the ocean. And that was really an eye-opener for me as well, not realizing how expansive their use of the ocean is. Mm. And they are, you know, when we were talking about concerns about ocean planning and is this going to negatively impact us and increase regulation, And to me, all I've got to do is listen to someone from the Navy who says how important it is to our national security and to their continuing ability to train in the ocean mm-hmm. and be ready, to ready our forces. You know, when they see the sense in it, then to me it's a pretty broad sense of support, I guess, for this type of approach.
So the Navy is exempt from some maritime regulations, for example, provisions of the International Marine Agreement on Marine Pollution, known as MARPOL. Will they be able to opt in and out of provisions of marine planning? Les or Stephanie?
You know, I think the short answer is no, in that the Department of Defense and Homeland Security are among the federal agencies that are directed by Obama's executive order, the National Ocean Policy, to coordinate with fellow federal agencies to make smart ocean planning happen. Mm-hmm. Right. And actually, I should say, the military agencies have been increasingly among the best at providing data to help populate, for example, in this neck of the woods, the Northeast Ocean Data Portal, and likewise in the Mid-Atlantic with their data portal.
Dana,
It's also important to realize that the National Ocean Policy actually does not enact any new laws. Its sole purpose is to harmonize all of the existing laws in order to ensure a sustainable benefit from the ocean. Right. So there's nothing new that anyone is telling anyone not to do. It's really just like serving as a future-looking traffic cop so that people don't run into each other.
Yeah. All right, Dana's giving us a call from Wellfleet. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning. Thank you. This kind of hits on something I was concerned about. Two things. I'll just sum them up. I hope ocean litter will be an issue, because especially non-biodegradable plastics like balloon releases, cigarette butts, and also the Navy. You just mentioned it, and I just thought of it. They want to do sonic tests, I guess some kind of which could endanger and stress marine mammals.
Yeah, sonar testing you're talking about, Danielle.
The echolocation system. Is there any plan to kind of regulate that? I hope the Navy's not going to, I hope that's going to be seriously addressed.
Right. Anybody want to tackle that? Les, Stephanie?
I hope so, too. this is an example of one of those sticky issues. The impact of sonic exercises by the military and the ocean on marine mammals and other marine life is a major concern. The Navy is concerned too. I mean, I can't speak for them, but it doesn't help the armed forces when they create a controversy. So given the new tools that we have to visualize these impacts, make people aware of them, I think even the Navy will be coming along a little more friendly way.
What about the litter issue that Dana brought up? I mean, we're talking ocean planning, but balloon releases happening on land. I mean, they're sort of two.
Right.
I mean, it impacts it, but again, it's not really part of what we're talking about in this context, right?
Well, it's part of it. It's part of it in the sense that as people become more aware of the ocean and how it works, there's a slightly better chance that they'll think about the fate of the plastics that they're using or releasing into the environment, those beautiful shiny balloons that escape from children's hands eventually land in the ocean, many of them. And leatherback sea turtles are wonderful creatures, but they're not terribly bright. Mm. And as far as they're concerned, those bags are jellyfish. Mm-hmm. And only a leatherback eats one of those and it's curtains.
Yeah.
So raising awareness about the unseen issues in the ocean will help us deal more effectively with the more visible evidence of our thoughtlessness, such as plastic waste.
Right. Les, in the film, you mentioned that there are zero non-take areas in the Gulf of Maine. Can you explain what that means and why you think it's an issue?
Yeah, a no-take area in the ocean is an area usually not that big. Where you just don't kill anything or remove anything. Mostly this is about fish and fishing, but not only. And the importance of no-take areas is that the areas where we do remove stuff that we need to make a living or to eat, those areas are affected by those removals. And you need seed areas that provide young animals and plants to recruit back into the areas where we've removed stuff. Our impact on the ocean now is so pervasive, so extensive and profound that we now really desperately need these no-take areas to make sure the ocean can continue to function. But as you might imagine, they're very controversial. Nobody wants them in their backyard. And they benefit only a few of the user groups. For example, a no-take area obviously is good for tourism because that part of the ocean will be just brimming with spectacular wildlife that people will pay to go see. Meanwhile, everyone else is sitting on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're controversial, and that's why they're essential.
So how is climate change factored into the ocean planning process?
I think that is I think that's a great question, and I'm glad you raised it. And I think one or more of us referred to earlier the notion of ocean planning being, as a planning exercise, future thinking and forward thinking. And so I think one of the key issues that all of us involved in this and all ocean stakeholders have is the need to look further into the future in our planning horizon so that, you know, the 2 to 5 year planning horizon is useful for certain things. But we really need to be looking 10, 25, 50 years down the road as best we can, to anticipate the changing conditions, particularly due to climate change. And I think the obvious ones that are sort of most talked about are sea level rise and coastal flooding, and those are real, and they're very important that we plan for them. There are many other predicted impacts from climate change that have an effect on the ocean and that will ultimately have an effect on the human populations that depend on them, such as warming and increasingly acidic ocean waters, really redistributing where the ocean life lives, including the fish that our fishing communities depend on. And so I think that there's a lot of sort of collective dialogue and investigation that an ocean planning process can encourage about what is it? What are our oceans going to look like and our coasts, 25, 50 years from now? And how can we begin to prepare to adapt to those changes so that we can remain, our communities can remain, economically viable, those industries that depend on the ocean. So that we can essentially get prepared.
Go ahead, Les.
Now, climate change has had one positive impact that I can think of, only one. And that is that it is forcing us, at least in this domain, in ocean planning, to turn all of those maps, all of that data, into a movie that peers into the future. And that's something that it took like a big crowbar to get us to do it. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be tremendously valuable. There are new technologies that we're developing to enable this. We can CAT scan the ocean. New mathematics that enable us to grapple with the complexities of a rapidly changing world. And just like the space program, it's going to have tremendous spin-offs. So anytime that we have a big, juicy problem to solve, it makes life better in lots of unexpected ways.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back.
But I'm not advocating climate change.
Yeah, no, nobody is.
Nobody is, yeah. I just wanted to go back to Stephanie's point about sea level rise and coastal change being exacerbated by climate change. And I think there's a really interesting intersection with ocean planning there, which is that, from the land-based side of things, as we're losing homes and losing beaches, we're talking about, okay, what is the right way to try to manage our coastlines? And one of the options, of course, is to dump a lot of sand there. And then the question comes, where does that sand come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, often it comes from digging up sand offshore. And so part of the ocean planning is figuring out where are the areas where we're okay with essentially mining, with digging big pits in the bottom of the ocean in order to have that sand to put on our beaches.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
That's exactly right. And if I could just add to that, I mentioned earlier that the Mass Ocean Management Plan, which is doing its first formal full-blown amendment, you know, or revision, basically giving it a refresh, that's one of the issues that the Commonwealth of Mass hopes to tackle, again, in a smart, integrated fashion, not just sort of looking at politically, you know, where could we tuck a sand and gravel mining spot and suffer the least backlash, but really looking at it in an integrated planning sense and try to discover where are the most appropriate places.
Well, since you mentioned, we should mention that people who want to become further involved in ocean planning in New England, the next meeting takes place in Cambridge, January 22nd and 23rd. And these meetings are open to the public and anyone can participate, right?
Correct.
Okay, good. So we'll put links on our website to all of that. So, Stephanie, you were talking about future planning. And, of course, the oceans are already extremely busy places, as we've been talking about, only going to increase, especially when you look at increases in shipping traffic and energy use. So as you formulate a plan, how far into the future are you looking?
Yeah. The short answer is there is not a uniform response to that. Each state that undertakes ocean planning, or each multi-state region, there are 9 regions identified in the National Ocean Policy. The time frame aspect isn't really nailed down, but I think increasingly resource managers at the state level and at the federal agency level are realizing that sort of the election cycle 4 to 5 year planning horizon is not sufficient. So hopefully we'll be seeing ourselves looking more towards the 25-50-year range.
Mm. And I want to mention that, again, Ocean Frontiers 2, A New England Story for Sustaining the Sea, we're going to be screening that film this Sunday in New Bedford at the New Bedford Historical Whaling Park. It is free, but you do have to sign up on our website, capeandislands.org. There's only a certain number of seats. A panel discussion to follow. Heather, you're going to be moderating that panel.
Yep, we're going to have Jen McCann, who's heading up the Rhode Island Coastal Planning process, hopefully also Priscilla Brooks, who works with Conservation Law Foundation, and then we'll have Mary Malloy, a maritime historian, to give us a little bit of the historical perspective and maybe what we can learn from our past about planning for our future.
It sounds like a lot of fun. And then, of course, as we mentioned, you can get that on our website. We mentioned earlier, folks who want more information on how to host their own screening, we'll have a link for that on our website as well. Closing thoughts, about 30 seconds if somebody wants to jump in.
Just a quick note that another great example the film shows is that in terms of ocean planning being a vehicle or a tool to help ocean uses understand each other and thereby minimize conflict, the film shows a great example both in the planning phase where a fisherman says, you know, it's not a blank slate out there, we know we have to participate in this, but also in the implementation on the water phase, and that's around the Block Island Wind Farm phase where the developer Deepwater Wind is working directly with the affected fishermen to jointly design and implement studies that will collect the data they need to work together better.
All right. Stephanie Moore, founding executive director of Sea Plan, Les Kaufman, professor of biology at Boston University, Karen Meyer, Green Fire Productions, and Heather Goldstone. Thank you all.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Alan Mattis and Tom Devlin for engineering and production assistance at WGBH. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.